Random House Audio presents Explosive 18, a Stephanie Plum novel by Janet Ivanovich. Read for you by Lorelei King.
Chapter 1. New Jersey was 40,000 feet below me, obscured by cloud cover. Heaven was above me, beyond the thin skin of the plain, and hell was sitting four rows back. Okay, maybe hell was too strong. Maybe it was just purgatory. My name is Stephanie Plum, and I work as a bail bonds enforcer for Vincent Plum Bail Bonds in Trenton, New Jersey. I'd recently inherited airline vouchers from a dead guy and used them to take a once-in-a-lifetime Hawaiian vacation. Unfortunately, the vacation didn't go as planned, and I'd been forced to leave Hawaii ahead of schedule, like a thief sneaking off in the dead of night. I'd abandoned two angry men in Honolulu, called my friend Lula, and asked her to pick me up at Newark Airport. As if my life wasn't enough in the toilet, I was now on the plane home, seated four rows ahead of a guy who looked like Sasquatch and was snoring like a bear in a cave. Good thing I wasn't sitting next to him, because I surely would have strangled him in his sleep by now. I was wearing airline-distributed earphones pumped up to maximum volume, but they weren't helping. The snoring had started somewhere over Denver and got really ugly over Kansas City. After several loud passenger comments suggesting someone take the initiative and smother the guy, flight attendants confiscated all the pillows and began passing out free alcoholic beverages. Three-quarters of the plane was now desperately drunk, and the remaining quarter was either underage or alternatively medicated. Two of the underage were screaming, crying, and I was pretty sure the kid behind me had pooped in his pants. I was among the drunk. I was wondering how I was going to walk off the plane and navigate the terminal with any sort of dignity, and I was hoping my ride was waiting for me. Sasquatch gave an extra loud snork, and I ground my teeth together. Just land this friggin' plane, I thought. Land it in a cornfield, on a highway, in the ocean. Just get me out of here. Lula pulled into my apartment building parking lot, and I thanked her for picking me up at the airport and bringing me home.
No problemo, she said, dropping me at the back door to the lobby. There wasn't nothing on television, and I'm between honeys, so it wasn't like I was leaving anything good behind.
I waved her off and trudged into my apartment building. I took the elevator to the second floor, dragged my luggage down the hall and into my apartment, and shuffled into my bedroom. It was after midnight, and I was exhausted. My vacation in Hawaii had been unique, and the flight home had been hellish. Turbulence over the Pacific, a layover in L.A., and the snoring. I closed my eyes and tried to calm myself. I was back to work tomorrow, but for now, I had to make a choice. I was completely out of clean clothes. That meant I could be a slut and sleep naked, or I could be a slob and sleep in what I was wearing. Truth is, I'm not entirely comfortable sleeping naked. I do it from time to time, but I worry that God might be watching, or that my mother might find out, and I'm pretty sure they both think nice girls should wear pajamas to bed. In this case, being a slob required less effort, and that's where I chose to go. Unfortunately, I was in the same wardrobe predicament when I dragged myself out of bed the next morning, so I emptied my suitcase into my laundry basket, grabbed the messenger bag that serves as a purse, and headed for my parents' house. I could use my mom's washer and dryer, and I thought I had some emergency clothes left in their spare bedroom. Plus, they'd been babysitting my hamster Rex while I was away, and I wanted to retrieve him. I live in a one-bedroom, one-bath apartment on the second floor of an aging, three-story, brick-faced apartment building located on the edge of Trenton. On a good traffic day at 4 a.m, it's a 10-minute drive to my parents' house or the bonds office. All other times, it's a crapshoot. Grandma Mazur was at the front door when I pulled to the curb and parked. She's lived with my parents since Grandpa Mazur took the big escalator to the heavenly food court in the sky. Sometimes I think my father wouldn't mind seeing Grandma step onto that very same escalator, but I can't see it happening anytime soon. Her steel gray hair was cut short and tightly curled on her head. Her nails matched her bright red lipstick. Her lavender and white running suit hung slack on her bony shoulders.
What a good surprise, Grandma said, opening the door to me. Welcome home. We're dying to hear all about the vacation with the hottie. My parents' home is a modest duplex, sharing a common wall with its mirror image. Mrs. Chiak lives in the other half. Her husband has passed on, and she spends her days baking coffee cake and watching television. The outside of her half is painted pale green, and the exterior of my parents' house is mustard yellow and brown. It's not an attractive combination, but it feels comfortable to me since it's been that way for as long as I can remember. Each half of the house has a postage stamp front yard, a small covered front porch, a back stoop leading to a long narrow backyard, and a detached single car garage. I lug the laundry basket through the living room and dining room to the kitchen where my mother was chopping vegetables. Soup? I asked her. Minestrone, are you coming for dinner? Can't. Got plans. My mother glanced at the laundry basket. I just put a load of sheets into the washer. If you leave that here, I'll do it later for you. How was Hawaii? We didn't expect you home until tomorrow. Hawaii was good, but the plane ride was long. Fortunately, I sat next to a guy who got off when we stopped in L.A., so I had more room. Yeah, but you were also next to Mr. Tall, Dark, and Mysterious, Grandma said. Not exactly. This got both their attention. How so? Grandma asked. It's complicated. He didn't fly back with me. Grandma stared at my left hand. You got a tan except on your ring finger. It looks like you were wearing a ring when you got a tan, but you're not wearing it no more. I looked at my hand. Bummer. When I took the ring off, I hadn't noticed a tan line. Now I know why you went to Hawaii, Grandma said. I bet you eloped. Of course, being that you don't got the ring on anymore would put a damper on the celebration. I blew out a sigh and poured myself a cup of coffee. I took a sip, and my phone rang. I dug around in my bag, unable to find my phone in the jumble of stuff I'd crammed in for the plane trip. I dumped it all out onto the little kitchen table and pawed through it. Granola bars, hairbrush, lip balm, hair scrunchies, notepad, wallet, socks, 2 magazines, a large yellow envelope, floss, mini flashlight, travel pack of tissues, 3 pens, and my phone. The caller was Connie Rizzoli, the bail bonds office manager. I hope you're on your way to the office, she said, because we have a situation here. What sort of situation? A bad one. How bad? Can it wait 20 minutes? 20 minutes sounds like a long time. I disconnected and stood. Gotta go, I said to my mother and grandmother. But you just got here, Grandma said. We didn't get to hear about the eloping. I didn't elope. I returned everything to my messenger bag, with the exception of the phone and the yellow envelope. I put the phone in an outside pocket, and I looked at the envelope. No writing on it. Sealed. I had no clue how it had gotten into my bag. I ripped it open and pulled a photograph out. It was an 8x10 glossy of a man. He was standing on a street corner looking just past the photographer. He looked like he didn't know he was being photographed, like someone had happened along with their cell phone camera and snapped his picture. He was possibly mid-30s to early 40s, and nice-looking in a button-down kind of way. Short brown hair, fair-skinned, wearing a dark suit. I didn't recognize the street corner or the man. Somehow on the trip home, I must have picked the envelope up by mistake, maybe when I stopped at the newsstand in the airport. Who's that? Grandma asked. I don't know. I guess I snatched it up with a magazine. He's kind of hot. Is there a name on the back? Nope, nothing. Too bad, Grandma said. He's a looker, and I'm thinking about becoming a cougar. My mother cut her eyes to the cupboard where she kept her whiskey. She glanced at the clock on the wall and gave up a small sigh of regret. Too early. I dropped the envelope and the photo into the trash, chugged my coffee, grabbed a bagel from the bag on the counter, and ran upstairs to change. 20 minutes later, I was at the bonds office. I use the term office lightly, since we were operating out of a converted motor coach parked on Hamilton Avenue directly in front of the construction site for a new brick-and-mortar office. The new construction had been made necessary by a fire of suspicious origin that totally destroyed the original building. My cousin Vinny bought the bus from a friend of mine, and while it wasn't perfect, it was better than setting up shop in the food court at the mall. Connie's car was parked behind the coach, and Vinny's car was parked behind Connie. Vinny is a good bail bondsman, but a boil on my family's backside. In the past, he's been a gambler, a womanizer, a philanderer, a card cheat, and I'm pretty sure he once had a romantic encounter with a duck. He looks like a weasel in pointy-toed shoes and too tight pants. His father-in-law, Harry the Hammer, for all purposes owns the agency, and due to recent scandalous events involving misappropriated money, gambling, and whoring, Vinny's wife, Lucille, now owns Vinny. I parked my junker Toyota RAV4 behind Vinny's caddy and checked out the scene in front of me. The cinder block shell of the new bonds office was complete. The roof was on. Workers were inside, banging in nails and using power tools. I looked from the construction site to the bonds bus, where I could see light creeping out from drawn shades. It all looked like business as usual. I wrenched the coach door open and climbed the three steps up to the cockpit and beyond. Connie was at the dinette table, her purse on the bench seat next to her. Her laptop computer was closed. Connie is a couple years older than me and a much better shot with a gun. She was wearing a magenta sweater with a deep V-neck, showing more cleavage than I could ever hope to grow. Her black hair had recently been straightened and was pulled up into a messy knot on the top of her head. She was wearing big, chunky gold earrings and a matching necklace. She stood when she saw me. "I'm going downtown to the courthouse," she said. "I need to bond out Vinny. He's been arrested and they won't let him write his own bond." Oh, boy. Now what? "He had a dispute with D'Angelo and took a tire iron to his Mercedes. D'Angelo fired off a couple rounds at Vinny's caddy. Vinny tasered D'Angelo, and that's when the police showed up and dragged them both off to jail." Salvatore D'Angelo was the contractor Harry had hired to rebuild the bonds office after it burned to the ground. D'Angelo was better known as the contractor from hell since he did everything his way, did nothing without a bribe, and worked on D'Angelo time, which had no relationship to an actual work week. "Well, at least it's nothing serious," I said. "Yeah, but it could be if D'Angelo gets bonded out before Vinny and comes back and sets fire to Vinny's bus." "Do you think D'Angelo would do that?" I asked Connie. "Hard to tell what D'Angelo would do. That's why I didn't want to leave until you got here to stand guard." Connie handed me the key to the gun cabinet. "You might want to pick something out and keep it handy." "You want me to shoot him?" "Only if you have to," Connie said, clomping down the stairs to the coach door in her 4-inch cork wedges. "I won't be long, and the files on the table are for you. They're the no-shows for court that came in while you were on vacation." Oh, great. I was supposed to babysit a bus that might at any moment go up in flames. On the other hand, Vinny was my cousin and employer. And without the bus, we'd be renting space from the adult bookstore or working out of Connie's Hyundai. All that still didn't mean I was willing to get toasted protecting Vinny's makeshift office. I took the failure to appear files outside, hauled a lawn chair out of the storage compartment under the bus, and set the chair in the shade. This way I could divert a Molotov cocktail and not get trapped inside a flaming inferno. I sat in the chair and paged through the files. Purse snatcher, armed robbery, domestic violence, a burglary suspect, credit card fraud, assault, a second armed robbery. I wanted to be back in Hawaii. I closed my eyes and sucked in some air, searching for the smell of the sea, and instead catching exhaust fumes and a funky stench coming off the construction dumpster. A car eased to a stop behind my RAV4, and two men got out. One of them was Salvatore D'Angelo, a short, barrel-chested guy with a lot of wavy black hair going gray. He was wearing pleated dress slacks, a silky black short-sleeved shirt, and a thick gold chain that was stuck in a mat of chest hair that looked slightly singed, no doubt from Vinny shooting a bunch of bolts into him with his taser. D'Angelo sauntered over to me and stood, hands in pants pockets, jiggling change.
"Hey, cutie," he said. "What's up? Any special reason why you're sitting outside? Like, are you looking for street business? 'Cause I might have some business for you, if you know what I mean."
I was thinking Vinny did the right thing when he tasered D'Angelo. "I'm just doing my job," I said. "I'm supposed to shoot you if you firebomb the bus."
"I don't see no gun."
"It's hidden."
"I bet," he said. "Let me know if you change your mind about taking care of my business. And give me some credit here. I don't firebomb buses in broad daylight. I do that shit at night when no one's around."
D'Angelo turned away and walked into the half-finished bonds office building, and I returned to my files. The subject of the last file in the stack was a surprise. Joyce Barnhart. She'd allegedly stolen a necklace from a downtown jewelry store and had assaulted the owner when he tried to retrieve it. Vinny had bonded her out of jail, and she'd failed to show for court 3 days later. I'd gone all through school with Joyce, and she'd made my life a misery. She was an obnoxious, sneaky, mean kid, and now she was an unscrupulous, self-serving, man-eating adult. From time to time, she tried her hand at working for Vinny in various capacities, but none of the jobs stuck. Truth is, Joyce made her money through serial marriage, and last I looked, she was doing just fine. Hard to believe she'd stolen a necklace. Easy to believe she'd assaulted the store owner. Chapter 2 Lula's red Firebird rolled to a stop in front of the bus, and Lula swung herself out from behind the wheel and walked over to me. Her hair was dyed pink and teased into a big puffball that looked surprisingly good against her brown skin. And her body was minimally contained by her orange spandex skirt and white scoop-neck tank top. She's a former hoe who gave up her street corner to work for Vinny as a file clerk. "You looking to get some sun sitting out here?" she asked. "Didn't you get enough of that in Hawaii?" I told her about Vinny and D'Angelo and how I was guarding the bus. "It's a hunk of junk anyways," Lula said. "What's up for today?" I asked her. "Are you filing?" "Hell no, I'm not getting stuck in the death trap bus. I'll go catch bad guys with you." She looked down at the files in my lap. "Who are we going to do first? Anything fun come in?"
"Joyce Barnhart."
"Say what?"
"She shoplifted a necklace and assaulted the store owner."
"I hate Joyce Barnhart," Lula said. "She's mean. She told me I was fat. Can you imagine?"
It wasn't exactly that Lula was fat. It was more that she was too short for her weight. Or maybe it was that there was an excess of Lula and not ever enough fabric. "I thought we'd save Joyce for last," I told Lula. "I'm not looking forward to knocking on her door."
Connie's Hyundai cruised down the street, made a U-turn, and parked behind the bus. Connie and Vinny got out and walked over to me.
"Is D'Angelo here?" Vinny asked.
"Yes," I told him. "He's inside the building."
Vinny narrowed his eyes and growled, doing his best imitation of a crazed badger backed into a corner, claws out.
"Cripes," Lula said.
"It's okay to go into the bus," I said to Vinny. "D'Angelo only blows things up at night."
We all stood looking at the bus for a moment, not sure we believed that to be true.
"What the hell?" Vinny finally said. "My life's in the crapper anyway."
And he disappeared inside the bus.
"What's with Joyce?" I asked Connie. "Did she really steal a necklace?"
Connie shrugged.
"Dunno, but it's gotten complicated. Frank Corda, the store owner who pressed charges, is missing."
"When did he go missing?" I asked.
"Later that same day. The nail salon across the street remembers the close sign on the front door around 4 p.m. His wife said he never came home."
"And Joyce?"
"Vinny bonded Joyce out right after she was arrested. She was scheduled for court 3 days later, and she never showed." "I bet Joyce snatched him," Lula said. "She'd do something like that. I bet she got him in chains in her cellar." "Wouldn't be the first time Joyce put a man in chains," Connie said. "But I don't think she's got him in a cellar. She isn't answering her phone, and I drove past her house last night. It was dark." "Holy cow," Lula said, staring at my left hand. "You got a white ring on your finger where you didn't get a tan. I didn't notice that last night on the way home from the airport. What the heck did you do in Hawaii? And where's the ring now?"
I made an effort not to grimace.
"It's complicated." "Yeah," Lula said. "That's what you said last night. You just kept saying it was complicated."
Connie examined my left hand.
"Did you get married while you were in Hawaii?"
"Not exactly."
"How could you not exactly get married?" Lula wanted to know. "Either you get married or you don't get married."
I flapped my arms around and squinched my eyes shut.
"I don't want to talk about it, okay? It's complicated."
"Excuse me," Lula said. "I was just saying. You don't want to talk about it? Fine, don't talk about it. Just because we're best friends don't mean nothing. We're like sisters, but hey, don't bother me if you don't want to tell me something."
"Good," I said, "because I don't want to talk about it."
"Huh," Lula said.
Vinny yelled at Connie from inside the bus.
"The phone's ringing. Get the friggin' phone." "You get the phone," Connie yelled back. "I don't do phones," Vinny said.
Connie made an Italian hand gesture at the bus.
"Idiot." I suppose we should do something, Lula said after Connie left to get the phone. What else have you got there?
I shuffled through my stack of skips.
Two armed robberies? Pass on them. They always shoot at us.
Domestic violence?
To the pressin', Lula said. What else you got?
A purse snatcher and credit card fraud?
I'm liking credit card fraud. They never have a lot of fight in them. They're always just sneaky little weasels. They just sit in the house all day shopping on the internet. What's this moron's name?
Lahanka Gouge.
Lahanka Gouge? What kind of name is that? That gotta be wrong. That's a terrible name.
It's what it says here. She lives in public housing. 40 minutes later, we were in Lula's car motoring through the projects and searching for Lahanka's apartment. It was mid-morning, and the streets were quiet. Kids were in school and daycare, hookers were sleeping, and the drug dealers were congregating in parks and playgrounds. There it is, I said to Lula. She's in 3145A. It's the ground floor apartment with the kids' toys in the yard. Lula parked, and we walked to the door, picking our way around bikes, stalls, soccer balls, and big plastic trucks. I raised my hand to knock. The door opened, and a woman looked out at us. She was my height, shaped like a pear, dressed in tan spandex pants and a poison green tank top. Her hair was standing straight out from her head like it had been spray-starched and ironed, and she had huge hoop earrings hanging from her earlobes.
"What do you want?" the woman said. "And I don't need any. Do I look like I need something? I don't think so. And don't touch none of my kids' shit or I'll turn the dog out on you."
And she slammed the door shut.
"She got a personality like a Lahanka," Lula said. "She even looks like a Lahanka."
I banged on the door, and the door got yanked open.
"What?" the woman said. "I already told you I don't want nothing. I got a business going here. I'm a working woman, and I'm not buying any cookies, moisturizer, laundry soap, or jewelry. Maybe if you had some quality weed, but you don't smell like weed pushers."
She tried to slam the door shut again, but I had my foot in it. "Lahanka Gouge?" I asked.
"Yeah, so what?"
"Bond enforcement. You missed a court date, and we need to reschedule you."
"I don't think so," she said. "You got the wrong Lahanka. And anyways, even if I was the right Lahanka, I wouldn't be going with you on account of I got stuff to do. I got a pack of kids who need new sneakers, and you're cutting into my prime earning time. I got eBay auctions going on, and I'm making timely purchases elsewhere."
Lula put her weight against the door and pushed it open.
"We don't got all day," she said. "We got a whole batch of idiots to bring in, and I got a lunch date with a deluxe Mr. Clucky Burger."
"Oh, yeah?" Lahanka said. "Well, Clucky Burger this."
And she gave Lula a two-handed shove that knocked her back 2 feet into me. I lost my balance, and we both went ass first to the floor. The front door slammed shut, security bolts slid into place, and Lahanka pulled the shade down on her front window.
"Probably she's not going to open her door to you again," Lula said.
I agreed. It was unlikely. Lula hauled herself up and adjusted her girls.
"Is it too early for lunch?"
I looked at my watch. "It's almost 1 o'clock in Greenland."
"That Lahanka took me by surprise," Lula said, finishing off her second Clucky Burger. "I wasn't on my game."
We were eating in Lula's car because there was a critical time limit to hanging out and clucking a bucket. Minuscule globules of fry fat floated in the air like fairy dust, and exposure lasting longer than 6 minutes left you smelling like Clucky Extra Crispy all day. It wasn't an entirely bad smell, but it tended to attract packs of hungry dogs and big beefy men, neither of which I was currently interested in. I pulled a file out of my bag. "Maybe we want to try the purse snatcher next."
"I don't think that's a good plan," Lula said. "Purse snatchers are runners. That's what makes them good purse snatchers. And I just had 2 Clucky Burgers. I'll get a cramp if I gotta chase after some skinny baggy pants idiot now. Don't we have a bad guy who lives by the mall? Macy's is having a shoe sale."
I checked the addresses. No one lived by the mall.
"I might need a nap after all that chicken," Lula said.
A nap sounded like a good idea. I hadn't gotten much sleep on the plane ride home. For that matter, I hadn't gotten much sleep the whole time I was in Hawaii, what with all the nighttime activity. And tonight I was seeing Morelli, and I suspected that wouldn't lead to a lot of sleep. Morelli and I had things to discuss. I have a long history with Morelli. We played choo-choo when I was 6 years old. He relieved me of my virginity when I was 16. I ran him down with a Buick when I was 19. And now that we're both adults, more or less, I sort of have a relationship with him, although I'd be hard-pressed to define the relationship at this moment. He's a Trenton cop working plainclothes, crimes against persons. He's 6 foot tall with wavy black hair, a lean, hard-muscled body, and a world-class libido. He's movie star handsome in jeans and a t-shirt. If you put him in a suit, he looks like a hitman. Are we talking about a cat nap or a full-on afternoon nap? I asked Lula.
It might be a major nap. And then I got a date tonight with a guy who could be Mr. Good Enough, so I'm going to need some time to make wardrobe decisions.
In other words, I'll see you tomorrow.
Yeah, I'll be here at 8 sharp and we could get an early start.
You're never here that early.
Well, I'm going to be motivated to be an excellent bounty hunter assistant. I can feel it coming on, and I'll be ready to go first thing in the morning after a satisfying night of doing, you know, cross my heart and hope to die.
Chapter 3. Lula dropped me at my car, and I took a fast assessment of the surroundings. Work was continuing on the new office. The bus wasn't in flames. D'Angelo's Mercedes was gone, and Vinny's caddy was still parked. All good things. I thought about checking in with Connie, but decided against it. I hadn't made any captures, and a conversation with Vinny might include a lot of unpleasant nagging about catching Joyce Barnhart. I'd get her eventually, but I wasn't up to it right now, so I jumped into my RAV and took off for my parents' house. An hour later, I was in my apartment building lugging my basket of clean clothes plus my hamster cage down the hall. I unlocked my door, pushed it open with a hip, and staggered into the kitchen, arms full. I set the laundry basket on the floor and the hamster cage on my kitchen counter. "Here you are back home," I said to Rex. "Did you have fun with Grandmom?" Rex was out of his soup can, looking like he wanted a treat, so I got the box of crackers from the cupboard and shared one with him. Someone rapped on my front door, and I opened the door a crack, leaving the security chain attached. Two men dressed in bureaucrat-level gray suits peeked in at me. Their dress shirts were long past crisp. Their striped ties were loosened at the neck. Their hair was receding. They looked to be late 40s. One was around 5'10". The other was in the 5'7" range. I suspected they liked their double bacon cheeseburgers.
"FBI,"
the big guy said, flashing me an ID, then returning it to his pocket.
"Can we come in?"
"No," I told him.
"But we're the FBI."
"Maybe," I said to the big guy. "Maybe not. I didn't catch your name."
"Lance Lancer."
He gestured at his partner.
"This is Agent Sly Slasher."
"Lance Lancer and Sly Slasher? Are you kidding me? Those can't be real names."
"It's right here on our badges," Lancer said. "We're looking for an envelope you might have inadvertently picked up."
"What kind of envelope?"
"A large yellow envelope. It contained a photograph of a man we're looking for in conjunction with a murder."
"Wouldn't that be a job for the local police?"
"It was an international murder, and there was a kidnapping involved. Do you have the envelope?"
"No." And that was the truth. I suspected they were looking for the envelope I'd thrown away at my parents' house.
"I think you're fibbing," Lancer said. "We have it on good authority you were given the envelope."
"If I find it, I'll give it to the FBI," I said. I closed and locked my door and put my eye to the peephole. Lancer and Slasher were standing hands on hips, looking mildly pissed, not sure what to do next. I went to the kitchen and dialed Morelli's cell phone. "Where are you?" I asked him.
"I'm home. I just got in."
"I need to check on two guys who claim they're FBI. Lance Lancer and Sly Slasher."
"I'll be a laughingstock if I plug those names into the system. This is a joke, right?"
"Those are the names they gave. They had badges and everything."
"How fast do you need this?"
"How fast can you get it?" Morelli grunted and hung up. I imagined Morelli staring down at his shoe, shaking his head, wishing he hadn't answered his phone. I dialed my parents' house, and my mother answered. "I need you to do something for me," I said. "I need the photo in the envelope I threw away when I was in the kitchen this morning. I tossed it in the trash."
"Your grandmother emptied the trash right after you left. Today was garbage pickup. I can look out back, but I think it's gone."
So it appeared I was out of the FBI evidence supply business.
Fine by me. I had better, more important things to do, like taking a nap. I kicked my shoes off and flopped onto my bed. I'd barely closed my eyes and the doorbell bonged. I heaved myself out of bed, padded to my door, and looked out the peephole. Two more men in cheap gray suits. I cracked the door, leaving the security chain in place, and looked out.
Now what? I said.
The guy standing closest to the door badged me.
FBI, we'd like to talk to you.
Names?
Bill Berger and my partner, Chuck Gooley.
Bill Berger was slim, average height, and in his early 50s. Salt and pepper hair cut short. Bloodshot brown eyes. Probably his contacts were killing him. Chuck was my age. Not fat, but a chunky body. An inch or two shorter than Berger. His suit pants had a lot of crotch wrinkles, and he was wearing ratty running shoes.
And you'd like to talk to me about what? I said.
Can we come in?
No.
Berger went hands to hips, exposing the gun clipped to his belt. Hard to tell if it was an unconscious gesture or if he was trying to intimidate me. Either way, I wasn't opening my door any wider.
We have reason to believe you are in possession of a photograph that's part of a crime investigation.
My phone rang, and I excused myself to answer it.
You've been home less than 24 hours, and you're already in some kind of a mess, Morelli said. Do you want to tell me about it?
Sure, but I've got guests right now. More FBI.
Are they in your apartment?
No, they're in the hall.
That's where you want them to stay. As far as I can tell, the first two guys aren't with the Bureau. There are no Lance Lancers or Sly Slashers on active duty. Big surprise. So who have you got in your hall now?
Morelli asked. Bill Berger and Chuck Gooley? Silence for a beat.
Berger's in his early 50s, black hair going gray, and Gooley looks like he's had the same suit on for 2 weeks, right?
Yeah. Should I let them in?
No. Gooley eats out of dumpsters and fucks feral cats. Let me talk to Berger.
I passed my cell phone out to Berger. 2 minutes later, Berger gave it back to me.
Do you know where the Bureau's located downtown?
Berger asked me.
Yep.
I'll meet you there tomorrow at 10 o'clock. Bring the photo.
I don't have the photo, I told him.
Then bring your lawyer.
I narrowed my eyes at him.
You need to practice your people skills.
Berger pressed his lips tight together.
I hear that a lot, mostly from my ex-wife.
I closed my door and got back to Morelli. I guess Berger is FBI?
More or less. I need to talk to you.
I figured. I hope to see you tonight.
I might be late.
How late? I asked him.
Hard to say. Someone just took 16 rounds to the head in the projects.
16 bullets to the head? That seems excessive.
Murray saw him, and he said he looked like Swiss cheese. Murray said the guy had brains leaking out all over the place.
Too much information.
It's my life,
Morelli said, and he disconnected. I went back to bed, but I kept thinking about brains leaking out from bullet holes. Morelli was the only one I knew who had a worse job than I did. Okay, maybe the guy at the mortuary who drains out body fluids was also in the running. Anyway, against all odds, Morelli liked being in law enforcement. He'd been a wild kid and the product of an abusive father. And now Morelli was a good cop, a responsible homeowner, and an excellent pet parent to his dog, Bob. I'd always thought he had superior boyfriend, maybe even husband potential, but his job was a constant, frequently grim intrusion, and I couldn't see that changing anytime soon. Plus, now there was the Hawaiian thing. The other guy in my life, Ranger, realistically had no boyfriend or husband potential whatsoever, but he was an addictive, guilty pleasure. He had a body like Batman, a dark and mysterious past, a dark and mysterious present, and an animal magnetism that sucked me in the instant I approached his force field. He wore only black. He drove only black cars. And when he made love, his brown eyes dilated totally black. I rolled all this around in my mind. Morelli, Ranger, the brains leaking out. Then I thought about the FBI guys, both fake and real, and the guy in the photo. And none of this was conducive to napping. Not to mention, I'm not on salary. If I don't capture skips, I don't make money. If I don't make money, I can't make my rent. If I don't make my rent, I'll be living in my car. And my car isn't all that terrific. I returned to the kitchen and went back over my files. I thought I had my best shot with the purse snatcher. True, they were usually runners, but the guy looked fat in this photo, and I might be able to run down a fat guy if he wasn't in top shape. His name was Louis Bugkowski, a.k.a. Big Buggy, 23 years old. He'd robbed an 83-year-old woman sitting on a park bench. 45 minutes later, Buggy was arrested when he tried to buy 6 buckets of fried chicken with the woman's credit card, and the counter clerk didn't think Buggy looked like a Betty Bloomberg. So, besides being fat, Buggy was probably not real smart.
I thought about taking my gun, but decided against it. It made my bag too heavy and gave me a neck cramp. Truth is, I never used the gun anyway. I took pepper spray and hairspray instead. I had my phone clipped to the waistband on my jeans and handcuffs in my back pocket. I was ready to roll. Buggy lived with his parents just slightly beyond Berg limits. This is always a bummer situation because I hate snagging people in front of their parents or their kids. I could get him at his workplace, but he hadn't listed any. I drove to Broad, hooked a left, and cruised by the Bukowski house. Small two-story Cape Cod. Clean. Tiny front yard, neatly maintained. One-car garage. No cars parked at the curb in front of the house. I dialed Buggy's phone, and he picked up after two rings. "Louis Bukowski?" I asked.
"Yeah."
"Are you the homeowner?"
"Nah, that's my dad."
"Is he at home?"
"No."
"Your mother?"
"They're both working. What do you want?"
"I'm conducting a survey on trash removal." Click. Buggy hung up. Great. I'd found out everything I needed to know. Buggy was in the house alone. I parked one house down from the Bukowskis, walked to their front door, and rang the bell. A huge guy answered. He was easily 6'3 and 300 pounds. He was wearing sweatpants and a t-shirt that could have provided shelter for a Vietnamese family of eight.
"Yeah?"
he asked. "Louis Bukowski?" He narrowed his eyes at me.
"Is this about trash? You sound like that girl on the phone."
"Bond enforcement," I told him. I whipped out my cuffs and attempted to clap one on his wrist. No good. The cuff wouldn't close. His wrist was too big. The guy was a mountain. I sent him a flirtatious smile. "I don't suppose you'd want to come downtown with me to reschedule your court date." His eyes locked onto my messenger bag.
"Is that what you use for a purse?"
Uh-oh. "No," I told him. "I use this for documents. Boring stuff. Let me show you." He grabbed the strap and ripped the bag off my shoulder before I could locate my pepper spray. "Hey," I said, "give it back." He looked down at me.
"Go away or I'll hit you."
"I can't go away. The keys to my car are in the bag." His eyes lit up.
"I could use a car. I'm hungry and there's no food in the house."
I lunged for my bag and he batted me away. "I'll drive you to Cluck in a Bucket," I said. He closed the front door and stepped off the porch.
"Don't need you. I got a car now."
I ran after him and latched onto the back of his t-shirt. "Help!" I yelled. "Police!" He shoved me away, crammed himself behind the wheel, and the car groaned under the weight. He rolled the engine over and took off. "That's Grand Theft Auto, mister," I shouted after him. "You're in big trouble." I watched Buggy disappear around a corner. I procrastinated a minute, then gave in and called Ranger. "Where are you?" I asked.
"I'm at Rangeman."
Rangeman was a security company he partially owned. It was housed in a nondescript building in the center of Trenton, and it was filled with high-tech equipment and large, heavily muscled men in black Rangeman uniforms. Ranger kept a private apartment on the 7th floor. "Some big dopey guy just stole my car," I said to Ranger. "And he has my bag, and he's FTA.
"No problem. We have your car on the screen."
Ranger has this habit of installing tracking devices on my cars when I'm not looking. In the beginning, I found the invasion of privacy to be intolerable, but I've gotten used to it over the years, and there are times when it's come in handy, like now.
"I'll send someone out to get your car," Ranger said. "What do you want us to do with a big dopey guy?"
"How about if you cuff him, cram him into the back seat, and drive him to the bonds bus? I'll take it from there."
"And you?"
"I'm good. Lula's on her way to pick me up."
"Babe,"
Ranger said, and he disconnected. Okay, so I fibbed to Ranger about Lula. Truth is, I wasn't ready to face him, especially since he sounded a tiny bit exasperated. I looked down at my naked ring finger, blew out a sigh, and called Lula. Chapter 4.
"You got soft in Hawaii," Lula said. "You lost your edge. That's what happens when you go on vacation and do whatever the heck it is that you did, which, by the way, I don't even care about no more."
Lula had picked me up at Buggy's house, and we were on our way to the bonds office. "I didn't go soft in Hawaii," I said. "I never had an edge."
That could be true about the edge, but you've been out after two felons now and they both whooped your butt. So I thought maybe it was on account of being distracted by whatever it is you're distracted by. Not that I care what it is. And notice what a good friend I am, even though you don't care to confide in me and I disturb my nap to rescue you.
I'm not distracted. You can attribute both whoopings to pure incompetence.
Well, aren't you little miss down on yourself? I can fix that. You need a donut.
I need more than a donut.
What, like chicken? Fries? Maybe one of them giant 2-pounder bacon burgers?
I wasn't talking about food, I said to Lula. You can't solve all your problems with food.
Since when?
I'm thinking about taking a self-defense class. Maybe learn kickboxing.
I don't need no self-defense class, Lula said. I rely on my animal instincts to beat the bejesus out of an offending moron.
That didn't always work for me. I wasn't all that great at beating the bejesus out of people. My fight-or-flight instinct ran more toward flight.
Now that I'm up from my nap, I'm in the mood to go after the big one, Lula said. I want to bag Joyce. Where's she living? Is she still in that hotel-sized colonial by Vinny?
No, the bond agreement lists her address as Stiller Street in Hamilton Township. So far as I know, Joyce is currently single, although that might be yesterday's news. It's hard to keep up with Joyce. She's a serial divorcee, working her way up the matrimonial ladder, kicking used-up husbands to the curb while negotiating lucrative settlements. She left her last marriage with a net gain of an E-Class Mercedes and half of a $1.5 million house. Rumor has it he got the guinea pig. Might as well have a look at Joyce's house, I thought. Make a fast run out to Hamilton Township, and by the time I got back, hopefully my car would be parked behind the bonds bus. 20 minutes later, we were rolling down Stiller.
This clump of houses is brand new, Lula said. I didn't even know this was here. This was a cornfield last week.
The clump of houses was called Mercado Mews, and it looked not only brand new, but expensive. It was a mix of single-family and attached townhouses. Joyce lived in an end unit of 7 attached homes. Each one had a 2-car garage. Everything looked fresh and spiffy. No activity anywhere. No cars parked on the street. No traffic. No one tending the azalea bushes. No one walking a dog or pushing a stroller.
Looks to me like lots of these houses aren't sold yet, Lula said. They look empty. Of course, Joyce's house looks empty, too.
According to the file notes, Connie had been calling every day, twice a day, since Joyce went missing. She'd called the cell number and the home phone, and no one ever picked up. Lula pulled to the curb, and we went to the door and rang the bell. No answer. She waded into the flower bed and looked into the front window.
There's furniture in here, but no Joyce that I can see. Everything looks nice and neat. No dead bodies on the floor.
Let's look around back. We skirted the house and discovered the backyard was sealed off with a 7-foot-high wooden privacy fence. I tried the fence door. Locked.
You're gonna have to kick it in, Lula said. I'd do it, but I'm wearing my Via Spigas.
We've done this drill many, many times. Lula was always wearing the wrong shoes, and I was inept.
Go ahead, Lula said. Kick it.
I gave a half-hearted kick.
That's a sissy kick, Lula said. Put something behind it.
I kicked it harder.
Huh, Lula said. You don't know much about kicking indoors.
No kidding. We went through this routine at least once a week, and it was getting old. Maybe I didn't need kickboxing lessons. Maybe I needed a new job.
One of us is going to have to alley-oop over the fence, Lula said.
I looked up at the fence. 7 feet. Neither of us was exactly Spider-Man. Who's going to alley and who's going to oop? I asked her.
I do the lifting, but I just got a manicure, and I notice you don't have a manicure at all. Only thing noticeable about your hands is a missing tan on your ring finger that I don't care about.
Okay, great, I'll do the lifting, but you're going to have to ditch the Via Spigas. I don't want to get gored by a stiletto. Lula took her shoes off and threw them over the top of the fence into Joyce's yard.
Okay, I'm ready. Give me a boost.
I tried boosting, but I couldn't get her off the ground. You're going to have to climb onto my shoulders, I said. Lula put her right foot on my thigh, hoisted herself up, and wrangled her left leg over my shoulder. Her spandex skirt was up to her waist, and her tiger-striped thong was lost in the deep, dark recesses of her voluptuousness.
Uh-oh,
she said.
What uh-oh? I don't like to hear uh-oh. I'm stuck. You got to get a hand under my ass and shove. Not going to happen.
She wrapped her arms around my head to keep from slipping, and we went over backward.
Whoomp.
Are you okay? I asked her.
Hard to tell with you laying on me. I might need a moment.
We both got up and reassessed the situation.
My viaspigas are on the wrong side of the fence, Lula said, tugging at her skirt. No way am I losing them viaspigas.
She hauled her Glock out of her purse and drilled 5 rounds into the gate lock.
Holy cow, I said. You can't do that. That's loud. Everybody's probably calling the police.
There's no everybody, Lula said. This here's a ghost town.
She tried the gate, but it was still locked.
Huh, she said. Maybe we could dig under the fence.
Do you have a shovel?
No.
Then you're going to have to decide between your manicure and your shoes, I told her.
Over you go,
Lula said. She got me to the top of the fence, where I hung for a moment, swung one leg and then the other, and managed to fall without fracturing anything. I opened the gate, let Lula in, and we looked in the back windows. Same deal. No Joyce in sight. Back door was locked.
I could get us in, Lula said. I could have an accident with one of these back windows.
No, no broken windows and no more shooting at doors. I can get Ranger to sneak me in.
I bet, Lula said. Not that it's any of my business or that I care about what's going on with you and Mr. Mysterious. Of course, if you were dying to tell me, I suppose I'd have to listen.
The only thing I'm dying to do is get out of here. We returned to Lula's Firebird, and she drove me back to the bond's office.
Looks to me like Ranger got your car washed,
Lula said, eyeing the RAV4 parked behind the bus.
I can't ever remember seeing it that clean. Ranger's like a full-service dude. He rescues your car from being stolen, and he returns it detailed. I'm guessing you must have made him real happy in Hawaii. Not that I care. I'm just taking a winger here.
It was more like I made him happy, and then I didn't make him happy, and then I made him happy. And then the shit hit the fan. He's just a clean kind of guy, I said to Lula.
Yeah, I could see that.
Lula took off, and I went to my car. The driver's side door had been left unlocked. The key was tucked under the mat. There was no big buggy in the back seat. I punched Ranger's number into my cell phone. Thanks, I said. Did you get my car detailed?
There was a problem with blood on your right front quarter panel, so Hal ran it through the car wash.
Oh, my God.
Nothing serious. Bukowski slipped resisting arrest and smashed his face into your car.
Where is he now?
Bukowski was screaming like a little girl and drawing a crowd, and Hal didn't have the paperwork to justify a capture, so he had to let him go.
Did Hal get my messenger bag?
Yes, he brought it back here to Range Man. He didn't want to leave it in an unlocked car.
Maybe you could mail it to me? I asked. I was really, really not ready to see him.
You can run, but you can't hide, Ranger said.
So true. I hung up and headed for home. I stopped at the supermarket and had my cart half filled with groceries when I realized I had no money, no credit cards, no ID. It was all in my messenger bag, with Ranger. Damn. I returned the groceries and called Morelli from my car. About tonight, I said. Is it going to involve dinner?
Not unless you want to eat at midnight.
Are you avoiding me?
I'm not that smart, Morelli said.
I sat for a long moment after Morelli hung up, reviewing my current choices. I could drive to Range Man and retrieve my bag from Ranger. I could go home and share a cracker with Rex. I could mooch dinner from my mom. 20 minutes later, I was at my parents' house, and Grandma was hustling to set a plate at the table for me. My mom had been making minestrone this morning, and that meant there'd also be antipasto, bread from the bakery, and rice pudding with Italian cookies. The table is set for 4, I said to Grandma. Who's coming to dinner?
This real interesting lady I met last week. I joined one of them bowling leagues, and she's on my team. You might want to talk to her. She's some kind of relationship counselor.
I didn't know you could bowl.
Turns out it's easy. You just gotta throw the ball down the alley. They gave me this shirt and everything. We're the LWB. That stands for Ladies with Balls.
My father was watching television in the living room. He rattled his newspaper and muttered something about women ruining bowling. He was watching national news, and a bulletin came on showing a picture of a man found dead at LAX. He'd been hit with a blunt instrument, had his throat slashed, and he'd been stuffed into a trash can.
Ugh,
as if this wasn't horrific enough,
I was pretty sure it was the guy sitting next to me for the first leg of the Hawaii flight home. I'd spoken to him briefly in the beginning, but slept for the rest of the trip. I'd been surprised to find his seat empty when we reboarded. My impression had been that he'd planned to fly into Newark. I guess this explained his absence. The doorbell rang. Grandma rushed to get it and ushered a brown-haired, pleasantly plump, smiling 40-something woman wearing a LWB bowling shirt into the living room.
"This is Annie Hart," she said. "She's the best bowler we got. She's our ringer."
I knew Annie Hart. I'd been involved in a Valentine's Day fiasco with her a while back and hadn't seen her since. She was a perfectly nice woman who lived in La La Land, firmly believing she was the reincarnation of Cupid. Hey, I mean, who am I to say, but it seemed far-fetched.
"How wonderful to see you again, dear," Annie said to me. "I think of you from time to time, wondering if you've resolved your romantic dilemma."
"Yep," I said, "it's all resolved."
"She got married in Hawaii," Grandma told Annie.
My father shot straight out of his chair.
"What?" "She had a ring and everything," Grandma said.
My father was wild-eyed.
"Is that true? Why didn't someone tell me? No one ever tells me anything around here."
"Look," I said, holding my hand in the air, "I'm not wearing a ring. I'd be wearing a ring if I was married, right?"
"You got a ring mark," Grandma said. "Of course, I guess there could be other explanations. You could have the vitiligo like Michael Jackson. Remember when he turned white?"
My mother put two platters on the dining room table. "I have antipasto," she said, "and I have a bottle of red open." My father went to the table, shaking his head.
"Vitiligo," he said. "What next?"
"Annie's been helping Lorraine Farnsworth with her love life," Grandma said, forking into a slice of hard cheese and prosciutto.
My mother looked over at Annie. "Lorraine is 91 years old."
"Yes," Annie said. "It's time for her to make a decision. She's been seeing Arnie Milhauser for 53 years. It might be time for her to move on."
My father had his head bent over his antipasto.
"Only place she's going to move on to is the Bone Farm."
"She's doing pretty good for her age," Grandma said. "Sure, she rolls her share of gutter balls, but heck, who don't?"
"She's doing better now that we got her the longer tubing to her oxygen tank," Annie said. Grandma nodded.
"Yeah, that helped. She was on a short leash before."
I had my phone clipped to the waistband on my jeans, and it beeped with a text message. "We need to talk to you. It's urgent. Come outside." It was signed the FBI. I texted back, "No." The next message was, "Come outside or we're coming in." I blew out a sigh and pushed away from the table. "I'll be right back," I said. "I need to step outside for a moment."
"Probably gotta let a breezer go," Grandma said to Annie. "That's always why I gotta step outside."
My mother drained her wine glass and poured another. I went to the front door, stepped onto my parents' front porch, and saw they were the fake FBI guys. They were standing at the curb in front of a black Lincoln. The bigger of the two, Lance Lancer, motioned me forward. I shook my head no. He pulled his badge out, held it up for me to see, and crooked his finger at me. I did another head shake. "What do you want?" I yelled.
"We want to talk to you. Come here."
"Move away from the car. I'll meet you halfway."
"We're the FBI. You gotta come to us," Lancer said.
"You're not the FBI. I checked. Besides, the FBI doesn't ride around in big black Lincoln town cars."
"Maybe we got it on account of it was confiscated," Lancer said.
"What do you want?" I asked him.
"I told you we want to talk, and I can't be yelling to you. It's confidential."
I moved off the porch onto the walk. "I'll meet you halfway," I said again. Lancer mumbled something to Slasher, and they walked over to where I was standing.
"We want the photograph you got on the plane," Lancer said. "Bad things are going to happen if you don't give it to us."
"I told you, I don't have it."
"We don't believe you. We think you're fibbing to us," Lancer said.
Good Lord, as if the vacation wasn't disastrous enough, now I'm involved in God knows what. "I don't have it. I'm not fibbing. Go away and bother someone else," I told them. Lancer's eyes narrowed.
"Get her," he said.
I whirled around and jumped away, but one of them managed to snag my shirt. I was yanked back, clawing and kicking.
There was a lot of swearing and ineffective bitch-slapping, and somehow my foot connected with Slasher's boys. His face instantly went red and then chalk white. He doubled over, hands to his crotch, and he went to the ground in a fetal position. I ran into the house, locked the door, and looked out the window. Lancer was dragging his partner into the Lincoln. I straightened my shirt and returned to the dinner table.
"Feel better?" Grandma asked.
"Yep," I said. "Everything's good."
"Your digestion will improve when we get your romantic problem solved," Annie said.
Little alarm bells went off in my head and my scalp prickled. We? Did she say we? I had enough trouble going on with the men in my life without Annie getting involved. Annie was a sweet person, but she was only a few steps behind Morelli's Grandma Bella in the Wacko of the Year competition. "Honestly, I haven't got any romantic problems," I told Annie. "It's all peachy."
"Of course it is," Annie said, and she winked at me.
"I hate to rush everyone, but we gotta get a move on," Grandma said. "Bowling starts at 7 o'clock, and you gotta get there early or all the good shoes are gone and only the fungus shoes are left. I'm gonna get my own shoes, but I have to wait for my Social Security check."
Rushing through dinner is never a problem. My father doesn't waste unnecessary minutes on bodily functions. He slurps his soup down boiling hot, has seconds, mops the bowl with a crust of bread, and expects to immediately move on to dessert. This no-nonsense approach to dinner gets him back to the television in record time and cuts down time spent tuning out Grandma.
"I was talking to Mrs. Kulicki at the bakery today, and she said she heard Joyce Barnhart was mixed up in something bad and got compacted at the junkyard," Grandma said, helping herself to an almond cookie.
"How awful," my mother said. "How would Mrs. Kulicki know such a thing? I haven't heard anything."
Grandma dunked her cookie in her coffee. "Mrs. Kulicki's son Andy works at the junkyard, and it came from him."
That would be a real bummer if it were true. It was a pain in the ass to get money back on a dead FTA, especially when the body was incorporated into the bumper of an SUV. Plus, I suppose I'd miss Joyce in a perverse, sick sort of way. After Grandma and Annie took off, I helped my mom with dishes and spent a few minutes watching television with my dad. No one mentioned rings or marriage. My family solves problems with silence and meatloaf. Our philosophy is, if you don't talk about a problem, it might go away. And if it doesn't go away, there's always meatloaf, mac and cheese, roast chicken, pineapple upside-down cake, pasta, potatoes, or bologna on white bread to take your mind off unpleasant things. My mother sent me home with a bag of cookies, a half pound of deli ham, provolone, and a loaf of bakery bread. If you come to eat at my mom's house, you leave with something in a bag. I stopped at the entrance to my apartment building parking lot and did a fast survey. No black Lincoln Town car in sight, and I was sure I hadn't been followed, so probably it was safe to go to my apartment. I took the stairs, walked the second floor hall, and listened at my door. Silence. I pushed the door open and peeked in. No fake FBI guys lurking in the kitchen. Most likely Slasher was sitting somewhere icing down his privates. I'd made a good connection. Imagine what sort of damage I could inflict if I actually knew what I was doing. I gave Rex part of a cookie, went to my computer, and searched around until I found a news story on the man murdered at LAX. His name was Richard Crick, age 56, surgeon, had an office in New Brunswick. He'd been in Hawaii attending a professional conference. Police were speculating it was a random robbery gone bad. I suspected different. Crick had something valuable. The photograph. He realized he was in danger, so he slipped the photograph of the man into my bag while I was sleeping. And then either he fingered me before he died, or else a bunch of people figured it out. I had no clue as to the significance of the photograph and didn't especially want to know. I tapped Crick into one of the bonds office background search programs and watched the information scroll down. He'd been an army doctor for 10 years. 3 were in Afghanistan, 3 in Germany. The rest stateside. He'd gone into private practice when he left the army. Divorced, 2 adult sons, 1 living in Michigan and 1 in North Carolina. Squeaky clean until a year and a half ago when he was hit with a wrongful death malpractice claim. So far as I could see, the claim was still pending. He owned a home in Princeton. The latest appraisal was $350,000. He owed $175,000 on his mortgage. he drove a 2-year-old Accord. No other litigation, no liens, no reports of bad credit. All in all, a pretty boring guy. No point is sneaking into his house and his office and looking around. I was coming to this game late. The fake FBI, the legitimate FBI, local police, employees, and relatives would already have combed through everything. I remoted the television on and surfed around, finally settling on the food channel. I fell asleep halfway through a food truck special and didn't wake up until 11:30. I checked my phone for messages, found none, and went to bed. Chapter 5. I awoke disoriented. The room was dark. An alarm was going off. I was next to a warm body. Morelli. He reached across me and shut the alarm off. The alarm had been coming from his cell phone. What the heck? I said. What time is it?
It's 5:00. Gotta go. Early briefing. And I need to go home and feed Bob before I leave for work.
When did you get here?
Around midnight. You were asleep.
So you just crawled under the covers? I thought we were having issues. He slipped out of bed.
I was tired. This was easy.
Easy? I was up on an elbow. Excuse me, easy?
Yeah, I didn't have to talk to you.
He kicked around in the dark, picking clothes off the floor.
These boxers are mine, right?
Who else would they belong to?
Could be anyone's,
Morelli said. I rolled my eyes and switched the bedside light on. Does this help? He tugged his jeans on.
Thanks.
Now that the room was partially lit, I could see the Band-Aid across Morelli's nose and his black eye. The fight in Hawaii had been violent but short, terrifying to witness and infuriating to remember. Ranger had needed 7 stitches to close the cut under his eye, and he'd cracked a bone in his hand rearranging Morelli's face. How's your nose? I asked Morelli.
Better. The swelling's down.
That fight was horrible.
I've been in worse.
I knew this to be true. Morelli'd had some wild years.